Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Normally on Monday in this space, there's an episode of Open Source's Guelph on this feed, but since we are taking a couple of weeks off from the show, it opened up a place that needed to be filled. So on this extra edition of the Guelph Politicast, we'll hear from Elizabeth May, who held a town hall in Guelph on July 15th, where she was flanked by Guelph Green Party candidate Steve Dick and Guelph MPP Mike Schreiner. Now, obviously, May feels pretty good about the Green Party's chances here in Guelph, and the polls have been highly favorable. So the some 200-odd people that came out to hear from her on a summer evening seem to bear that out. May touched on a lot of different topics, but obviously the lion's share of the discussion was about climate change and the need to address that from a variety of different vantage points, including the economy, social justice, and how we can talk about the issue without sounding defeatist. So, enough from me. Let's flash back to Peter Clark Hall on the U of G campus back in July to hear from Elizabeth May.
Thank you all. Thank you all so much. Sorry, I couldn't sort of a take charge person, grab a table, haul it over, knock over a chair. The podium is slanty and I need my water. First of all, I know we're starting a bit late. I have to apologize. Well, no Canadian should really be so Canadian that they feel an urge to apologize for Air Canada. But I'm really sorry. I'm so sorry. So, thank goodness I got here at all, really, because, you know, when you're sitting on the tarmac, you realize you're, okay, so there goes having that fun thing at Brass Club first, and there goes, and then you're thinking, okay, maybe I'm not even going to get there for that. And all of you, it's a huge honor to be in front of a room full of people who are on a warm summer night crammed in this hall, which, while it has many wonderful attributes, beauty isn't among them. So I appreciate you waiting for me and staying here, and I'm also super grateful to my colleagues. Obviously, Mike Schreiner is in every way exceptional. I had it bad when on May 2nd, 2011, well, I mean, it was great to be elected, but on May 2nd, 2011, I realized as I cried myself to sleep that night, and that is not figurative, that's literal. I sobbed because Harper had a majority. I won my seat and I thought, well, I didn't think that was going to happen. Oh my God. So, Mike, I don't know how you went to sleep that night, but you got elected at Doug Ford as premier. So, holy. But Mike has distinguished himself so exceptionally by being the only real opposition. And Steve Dick is a fantastic candidate for Guelph, as you've just heard, and I can tell from the applause you give him that you agree with me. He should be the next. He will be the next. Yeah. My shtick here tonight isn't really to give a big partisan rally kind of a speech. This is one, this meeting tonight is one of a series. You've probably seen that it was described on the posters and on the website as a Community Matters event. So we've been holding Community Matters town halls across Canada. I've been trying to do them as much as possible by train. Well, that'll start again later, but in February by train, we did the Maritimes. In the first 2 weeks of March, we managed to you know, when you're taking Via Rail anywhere across country, you get off, you're off for 4 days because the next train's going to come in 4 days. So we sort of, you know, get in a Tesla, someone volunteer or a smart car, and do, you know, use the Via Rail stop as a hub to get to lots of other places. Try to find buses where there's still buses. Anyway, the last Community Matters tour, but tonight is Community Matters tour number 26. We've been at so far we've been, except for Newfoundland and Labrador, which will be the end of this month, we've been at every province, and we finally got to a territory. So my last Community Matters town hall was July 5th in Yellowknife. And it was fantastic, right? Amazing. And the local Greens said, you know, we thought maybe 50, but there seems to be a lot of interest, so we've set up chairs for 100. And there were 250 people in Yellowknife. Something is really happening. And by the way, in the territories, for the first time ever, I mean, we know there was a legendary nomination meeting here in Guelph with so many candidates on the ballot and ballot after ballot. But in Northwest Territories, we've never had a contested nomination before. We had two candidates, both exceptional. And so after I left Yellowknife was when they had about 6 days later was the nomination meeting. And our candidate there, I think, summed it up really well. His name is Paul Falvo. He's a lawyer and a former member of Yellowknife City Council. He's a really great candidate. And he said, well, you know, last election, I wouldn't have thought we had a hope in hell. But I really think we've got a hope in hell. Anyway, what I wanted to do tonight, and because of a lack of time, I want to make sure we have maximum time to hear from you. So I'm going to shorten up what I was going to say. The reason the Greens call this the Community Matters Tour is that we believe communities matter. This is what makes Canada, in a lot of ways, the cultural identity of Canada. Our values start with community. I think they also involve compassion and caring and a sense of citizenship that's about community. But the second double entendre part of the Community Matters Tour is we're here to hear what matters in this community. We are almost finished. We're at the point of dotting the I's and crossing the T's on the national platform. The platform, by the way, of course, deals with every issue under the sun. That we're Greens. If there's an issue of policy that we haven't considered, including the square footage of cages for hens, I mean, if there's something we haven't considered, I can't imagine what it is. But anyway, we also believe in being fiscally responsible. So I can tell you right now that the larger architecture of our platform is to implement Mission Possible, our climate plan to deliver on holding global average temperature, and Canada to do our fair share of holding global average temperature to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. That is our plan. We call it Mission Possible for a reason. It's possible. It's not mission easy. It says we're going to cut greenhouse gases and we're going to cut our dependency on fossil fuels by 60% below 2005 levels by 2030 and zero by 2050. And it's required because we understand the science. Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org and is such a wonderful environmental author and through all this work, we're great friends, but Bill was giving a speech at University of British Columbia recently and saying, you know, in most issues, politicians will say, well, there's this position here, and on the other side, there's a position here, and if we can meet somewhere in the middle, we'll have good policy. And on many issues, that's totally true. But as Bill says, you can't negotiate with physics. Nobody's meeting us in the middle here. We've got to do what the science tells us we must do. So years ago, when my daughter and I were marching in New York before the Paris negotiations, actually right before the Peru climate negotiations in September 2014, that my favorite sign that I saw on the street with 400,000 people marching was, it is time to stop debating what is possible and start doing what is necessary. And that's where we are on this. We're honestly confronting a challenge where I'm prepared to tell the other party leaders in debates, this isn't about politics. It can't be about politics, or we will continue to talk in trivial examples of incremental change because everybody will be too worried that telling the truth won't win them votes. But it's time for the truth. It's time to live up to the challenge of Gunther Thornburg and his grown-ups. Be prepared to bear the moral burden of telling our children we may have stolen their future, but it's time we gave it back. So, yes, climate action and the fact that this is a climate emergency is central to what we must do in this election, because by 2023, the next election, it will be too late. I know that Steve is referring to the 12 years because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on October 8th, 2018 said that we have to cut emissions by at least globally 45% by 2030 or it will be too late. But you can't start a trajectory to cut that many emissions starting in 5 years. Huh. This is huge. It will require Herculean, transformative efforts from every level of government, from multilateral UN agencies, individual governments, right down to every indigenous community, every single municipality, every province, every state. So for Canada, this is it. This is the election where we make a change. Because I really think we've got something like 24 months, maybe 46 months, maybe 36 months. We have to make the changes very, very much in the immediate short term. Start the changes, right? Because if you're going to deliver on a deadline in 2030, it's like going on a diet, saying, you know, my doctor tells me that sensibly I can stay healthy and doing all the right things, I can lose 20 pounds by New Year's Day. It's a good goal. But, you know, until Christmas, I'm good to eat cake every day. Because, you know, I've got till New Year's Day. Okay. The other parts of our platform that are really critical are about social justice. We will never get climate action without equity. We need to take that into. So we'll be having very detailed proposals on how we get universal pharmacare, detailed proposals on abolishing tuition, detailed proposals on every topic. We will do all those things in one platform, which, by the way, will also be fully costed. With a deadline to have balanced budgets, we just picked a random year. We figured we'll pick the same year Scheer picked. Why not? And to do that, well, to balance our budgets within 5 years and do all these programs obviously means we're not a party that embraces austerity. We have to do big things, and that means we have to find new sources of revenue without increasing taxes on average Canadians. So we think we've done it, but our current budget is currently in the hands of the Parliamentary Budget Office, and they're crunching the numbers to make sure we're right. We won't release the platform until we're sure we got it right. And then we'll have an independent agency say, yeah, they're fiscally responsible, and they're gonna have climate action, and they're gonna have social justice. And that's my commitment to you. So far as we know, as of now, we're the only party that is submitting our full budget to them. So that's another way. I hope a lot of you are going to be going door to door when people ask you questions about, well, the Greens, but what can they really do, and what do they know about government? I think actually I'm the most experienced leader and the best prepared to be Prime Minister. So. Really honest, and I don't want anyone here to think I'm delusional. What I really think we need to achieve in this election is a minority parliament that actually looks a lot like the parliament we should have gotten if Justin Trudeau had kept his promise. Yeah. Because we're going into an election where, for the first time in quite a while, the conservative side of the vote is split. Right? People may not be counting on Max Bernier to do hugely well in terms of his election of MPs. It's a prospect that you know, in any case, Max is a friend of mine in Parliament. He used to sit right next to me till Paul Manley was elected, and which was so great. Paul Manley was elected. So it was good to have reinforcements, but Max used to sit right next to me. And then when Paul got elected, the people who organized the seating in the House came over to me and said, we don't really have room for Mr. Manley to join you in this corner. Well, of course they would have if they'd be willing to move Max to the far corner where we went. But the far corner where we went, where I thought was a very congenial neighborhood, really wasn't Max's neighborhood. It was Jody Wilson-Raybould, Jake Philpott, Selena Sobchak, Cesar Chavanez, Hunter Tutu. So we all, well, again, But Max always said to me, Elizabeth, when you're in front of a crowd, please tell them that I am the most honest. Oh, except for you. But I am honest because I will do nothing on climate change. Nothing. And neither will Scheer, but he won't say it. So that's our conservative side of the spectrum is split. At least a little. Enough. So So every ballot in Canada, and in Quebec, one more, but every ballot across Canada except Quebec will have five parties on the ballot that already have members of parliament in the House. That hasn't happened for a long time. If everybody, and in Quebec, of course, six, because you have the Bloc Québécois. The chances of a minority parliament are high right now, so high that even the major media pundits are now debating whether the Greens will hold the balance of power in a minority parliament, where we go. Usually they don't even speculate about this kind of thing as a remote hypothetical, and now they're kind of taking bets on it. So that is my goal. That's why we need Steve Dick in parliament. Because every single seat held by Greens is a seat committed to cross-party cooperation and delivering what Canada needs, not about expanding power for ourselves. We will never put power ahead of principle. So. That leaves me, if we stay on schedule, that leaves all of us, I'm going to keep looking at my clock here, with about, and it leaves us with 25 minutes for questions and answers, which isn't nearly enough. So we'll certainly do a half an hour of questions and answers. I will try to keep my answers short. Those of you who know me know this is not my forte. I like to launch into a digression within a digression that explains a further question I thought of while someone else was asking the question. I'm going to try not to do that, because in the Community Matters Tour, what we're doing, I keep good notes, and people with me keep notes, so that when we go away from this, we know what was on the mind, what's the hot topic issues that voters in Guelph are thinking about. So it looks to me like there are two microphones, is that correct? Mike, you can help me moderate this?
I'm going to help you,
oh,
yes.
Mike's going to help me. Yay, Mike! But can I tell you something? You guys are going to feel so cool when the election's over. I can tell you how cool I feel, because at home, my MLA, Adam Olson, Starkville First Nation, is green. And he feels cool, because his MP, me, is green. So when you have a green MPP, and a green MP, you'll be among the coolest people in the country.
All right.
I'm going to help. And I just did a number of town halls and took a couple ground rules. Short question, please. There's a lot of people in the room. I'm going to try to keep us on time. And so I don't want to be rude, but if you're starting to go long, I will cut you off, okay? And that applies to Elizabeth, because I'm like her, I can talk forever. And I'd like to have a diversity of questioners, too. Sometimes only certain people like to come to the mic, and we want to leave a little
bit. Would those be white men?
Yeah, just, you know, maybe. Probably. We had to call a few of the white men out, and bring a few of my town halls and say, come on, let others come up. And the other one is, we're going to leave a little bit of time at the end for people who don't feel comfortable asking questions to talk to us and do photos. Yeah. So that's why we want to finish in half an hour. So why don't we start?
And I just want to say, please say your name when you ask your question. And I also want to just apologize for what I just said about white men. I love you. I just married one, so I'm going to...
Okay, ready to go? The microphones are right here. Yeah, go ahead. Go.
You go, go, go.
Awesome. Go for it.
We're lining
right
up.
Here. Go for it. You're up first. Yep.
My name is Valerie. I'm from Hamilton with the Hamilton Centre Green Party. I would like to ask Elizabeth how we are supposed to respond to people's comments on Warren Kinsella. Because I don't know what to say to them.
Well, the truth is that he's playing a very minor role in the national office in a group that's going to respond to attacks on us. I have a very strong ethical framework. Greens believe in doing politics differently. I'll be honest with you, this was something that I wouldn't think would have worked. But he has met with me and said, and he understands, because I told him that I thought what he did in politics previously has been despicable. And he said, yeah, so, but actually, well, if you're working with us, that can't happen at all. He's not a senior strategist. He's not in the senior campaign team. He's not a campaign manager. He's playing a role. I think the best way to describe it was what Jeff Wheeldon said, who's one of my shadow cabinet members, is if you think you've got a hacking problem, sometime you've got to hire a hacker.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Over here.
Hi there. I'm Judith. I'm from Guelph, and I'm campaigning for Steve. And one of the questions we put forward, or one of the topics, that kept coming up over and over, people were choosing it as a is affordable housing.
Yes.
What do you have to offer for people who are interested?
Well, we have, thanks a lot, Judith. It's a problem across the country. I don't know any community that isn't struggling with affordable housing. Well, I suppose in Newfoundland and parts of Cape Breton, the problem is depopulation. You can't get anyone to move into the houses we've got, and they don't cost much. But for most of Canada, for most Canadians, particularly for young people, the thought of being able to afford to buy your own home is a vanishing prospect. So our affordable housing plan within the platform, which isn't released yet, but Vision Green talks about it too. By the way, any of our policy questions that we don't get to tonight, I hope you know that if you go to greenparty.ca, there's a way too long document called Vision Green. You can search out the issue you're interested in and see what our positions are. On affordable housing, we break it down into different components. There's social housing, the right to housing. We recognize a right to housing, that every Canadian needs a roof over their head. And if you're in poverty or addiction issues or distress, housing first works as a principle. Get someone a roof over their head in their own house. So funding for social housing, responding to needs, and by the way, ending poverty with a guaranteed livable income is something we'll be working into that plan. But I think your question goes to market force housing, where we need to have more available purpose-built apartment units that are rentable and affordable to help ease that crunch. We need, and that, by the way, we used to have a federal tax treatment that encouraged developers to build purpose-built rental units, and that ended in the early 70s. So you'll notice that the rental stock we have is old, because that was the last time the federal government gave that incentive for purpose-built rental housing. We also have in mind a real focus on CMHC to be back in the housing business, focus on models that work like cooperatives, focus on more models like co-housing, reimagine the way we think of housing to build community, to have more intergenerational housing available. But bringing down the stress tests on mortgages has been really tough on Canadians. We also have to take, we do need a full inquiry into the impact of money laundering on housing stock. And one other piece I'll just throw, there's a lot of elements to our plan, but one that may be relevant, is about 20% of housing, I don't know how many derails this, about 20% of available housing stock has disappeared because of Airbnbs. So we need to regulate and tax Airbnbs.
Thank you. Hi, Elizabeth. My name is Jaden. I am originally from rural Manitoba, and I came to Guelph to go to the University of Guelph. And something that I've noticed both in Manitoba and in Guelph is there's a big focus on agriculture and on food production as a lifestyle and a way of living for a lot of low-income people. And so my question for you is, how is the Green Party going to market their strategy and make it inclusive for folks whose entire living relies on fossil fuels? How can we message to those people that voting green is still a good option for them when their entire way of living is going to have to change?
One of the sectors most at threat from climate crisis is farming and agriculture. They're experiencing massive drought. I've got a lot of friends from, well, I've got friends on the prairies. A lot of them are conservative MPs who never really connect them. But this last fall, before they could harvest crops, there was snow. We've been experiencing completely, climate crisis weather isn't predictable, and it sure isn't good for farmers. All of us have been dependent on fossil fuels, but we don't need to be. There are better alternatives. So In our strategy Mission Possible, we talk about fuel switching for that area of the economy where it's not obvious that you can get rid of fossil fuels. Like, I mean, John Deere is making an electric tractor. Okay, they are. But a lot of people aren't going to go out and buy a John Deere electric tractor. It makes a lot more sense for fishing boats, for forestry equipment, and for farmers to be able to switch to biodiesel. Biodiesel works just fine in the equipment they currently have. And making biodiesel can be done locally, providing more local jobs in a local economy. There's a biodiesel plant near Owen Sound that runs entirely on stale, dated base oil margarine. And as someone who loves cooking and eating, I think that is the highest purpose for a base oil margarine. A lot of wood waste, sawmills, pulp mills. So biodiesel is not an endorsement of, for instance, growing corn for ethanol, but fuel switching for farmers. And also there's more. We need to support farmers because regenerative agriculture can be fantastic for sequestering carbon. A lot of it already is. Farmers do volunteer, as a voluntary measure, environmental plans on farm. They're helping to protect hedgerows and biodiversity, and as much as possible, we need to secure wetlands as part of a natural infrastructure. Farmers should be paid for environmental services that they protect.
My name is Ruth, I'm from Guelph. I organize the Fridays for Future rally every Friday, yes, I will. So my question, I posed this to Steve a couple weeks ago, but I'm curious about your perspective. When I'm out there, my slogan is let's talk climate change, and my mandate out there is to inform people about climate change and just keep the conversation going. And the biggest thing I've noticed being out there is that people don't want to talk. They don't want to talk about it because, one, they're scared of it, or they don't know enough, or they just haven't connected the dots between how climate change is going, what climate change is and how it's going to affect them in their daily lives. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious why the Green Party or anyone really is not marketing climate change the way Ford is marketing anti-climate change. You know, I see ads and things all over Ontario about anti-carbon tax stuff, and like, I'm wondering
why. He is stealing public money to do that. We all realize this. I'm not premier of a province where I could take tax revenue for ads.
Okay.
And if I was a premier of a province, I wouldn't take tax revenue for ads for propaganda on any issue. The reality, of course, I didn't take that.
That's okay.
That was pretty much it. Okay, so why we're not putting money towards marketing so people can understand it better.
We don't have money. Yeah. Okay. That's my straight up answer. We are going into it. I mean, I don't want to scare people, but we're going into the 2019 election with less money than we had in 2015.
Okay.
That's because when Stephen Harper killed the per vote subsidy, we had a bit residual that kept coming right up till 2015. It's gone now. We're raising money more than ever, but the party strategy in terms of what's determined by staff, and by the way, the Green Party, I'm not in charge. My job description is to be the chief spokesperson. If it was me, I might have taken the money that got spent on something else and said, let's do this big ad campaign. All I can tell you is we talk about it all the time. We're doing everything we can to tell people about Mission Possible. If you can, in your social media, talk to people, encourage them to look at our plan for how to go off fossil fuels completely by 2050. If you can encourage people, I mean, the person whom I really respect, I respect a ton of scientists in climate change, but one of the best communicators is Catherine Hayhoe. And I don't know how many of you follow Catherine Hayhoe in social media. She's a Canadian, she's a climate scientist, she lives in Texas, and she's an evangelical Christian, which is really helpful if you're trying to educate Texans. And what she says is, talk to everybody. And I think one of the reasons people don't want to talk about it is fear. If we talk about it and we really face facts, it's scary. But marshaling everyone together in the biggest enterprise we've ever embarked upon, well, I mean, except for the Second World War. And that's why a lot of what we put in Mission Possible starts with status quo decision making is over. This is not a political issue. This is a survival issue, and we should act like it. And what Mission Possible calls for is that we pull together an inner cabinet with members of all parties. Because we've got to make decisions for all of us that stick, that don't change when an election's over. So we're talking about empowering our citizenry to be part of a solution. So government doesn't do it all, private sector doesn't do it all. It happens that Mike and I are both members of Rotary in our respective communities. I'd like to put out a big challenge for Rotarians across Canada. How many trees do you think we can plant? Because we've got to plant millions of trees. How many trees can we plant? How many solar panels can we put on? How many church roofs? How do we do this together? And I believe firmly that the issues that we're facing have changed dramatically. I mean, the climate crisis isn't Hitler. And the invading armies are not coming from a foreign power. But we are absolutely at risk of losing our society. So what doesn't change between 1940 and 2019 is human nature. And people will want to avoid facing something scary unless someone tells them, don't be scared, we have a plan, you're part of it, let's get to work. Finally, some gender parity.
Well, there we go, we finally have
that. I'm Dan Anschlock. I'm a math professor here at the university. I'm an immigrant, having moved here from the United States 14 years ago, something that just keeps getting better. One thing that makes me very proud to be Canadian is that even though we're a tenth the size of the United States, we took in about 10 times as many refugees from the Syrian civil war. That civil war started in a series of crop failures. It is arguably the first climate change war. There will be more. This leads me to something I see missing in the Mission Possible. 50 million to 100 million people are going to try to move to Canada in the next 40 or 50 years. That could be an economic and climate disaster or a real opportunity. We need a plan?
Yeah. And thank you, Dan. Mission Possible is a very, very short form of how we get to 60% reductions below 2005 levels by 2030 and zero by 2050. Environmental refugees, I love global Greens, so just as a shout out to the fact that there are Green parties in 80 countries around the world. Most of the things we've got in our plans have been tried elsewhere and worked, so we know they work. They've worked in Germany, they've worked in New Zealand, they've worked in Sweden, and on. At a global Greens gathering, in Sao Paulo, probably 9 years ago, we recognized that the definition of refugee has to change to incorporate environmental refugees and climate refugees. And our platform is fully on board with welcoming more immigrants, welcoming more refugees. And one reason, by the way, is when we sketched out the workforce that's required to meet Mission Possible, it has more jobs than we have workers. So every other politician is screaming about, if we act on climate change, what will happen to the jobs? My question is, if we act on climate change, we don't have enough workers. We need every single Canadian fully employed in this venture, and we need people to help us from other places. And we should always keep our arms wide open to refugees. And while I'm on a rant, we should stop calling the United States a safe third country. It's not.
Warn everyone that there's no way we're going to have enough time for all of these questions, so try to keep them quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. We'll make sure the young people.
We'll make sure we need some age diversity as well, so thank you.
Whoever's going first, can I have a question?
Okay, so my question.
What's your name?
My name is Eleanor Hayward. I'm the candidate for Milton.
Lisa Ray, watch out.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to a conversation with her.
Okay.
On the topic of the triple bottom line, in 2012, you moved for the Genuine Progress Measurement Act and a genuine progress indicator. For those who don't know, a triple bottom line, looking sustainably for fiscal, but also social, community, and also environmental ecology. How do we measure that moving forward? Because I do understand that Canada has accounting of the GPI. So can you clarify where that is now and where that is moving forward?
Canada currently doesn't. I mean, the GDP is a measurement, measures nothing of value in terms of survival. It's a measurement of how much cash changes hands. I'm sure I don't need to do a rant with this gang about what happens when a plane crashes and the GDP goes up because there's work for ambulance drivers and work for coffin makers and so on. it's not a useful measurement. So we would keep using GDP for certain things, but we need a genuine progress indicator that tells us the health of our forest, our literacy rate, how women are doing in childbirth, all the things that really matter. And we don't have one in Canada yet, but we could. And that's one of the things that's in Vision Green and in the platform. Thanks so much, Eleanor.
Thanks to the group over here for letting the young folks come up. So go ahead, you're next.
My name is Jaya. So my question is, how do you get people to like care about the environment and to like take action? Like, your talking is very inspiring, but not everyone can access that. So what are some other strategies you have to get the message out?
Thank you. The good news I want to share is that revolutions happen in countries not when the majority agrees, but when you get a significant group of people who are fully committed. Somewhere around 20 to 25% is enough to change a whole society. So people who are really committed and spread the word and talk to their friends and talk to the people at the checkout counter in the supermarket and talk to their hairdressers and just talk to everyone, which is what Catherine Neo said, can really change everything. My strategy, of course, is to try to get everywhere all the time and talk to as much media as will talk to me. We're going to try to use social media. We're going to try to get the word out every single way we can. That, because I think it's important for people to know, we have hope. There is a plan. We know our way out of this, and we need to do it together. And I'm very inspired that you came tonight. I just wanted, would you mind if I ask your age?
I'm 12.
Yep, I wrote down Jay at 12 years old. I nailed it. I want to thank you for coming. And if you have better ideas for what we should be doing, please tell me, because we can always use better ideas.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Owen. I am 11 years old, and I'm volunteering for the Green Party.
That's a great question, Ellen. Did everybody hear everyone's question? Yeah, okay. So what we're going to do is this is Mission Possible, and we've got all the crunching of the numbers of where we get our oil and how much oil Canadians need while we go off oil. So some of the last place we'll go off oil is, it'll be declining rapidly, is oil sands. Because they're Canadian, we want to have enough time to make sure that workers in Alberta transfer their skills to other things quickly. Now, given that we're going to go to 60% less than 2005 levels by 2030, this isn't a lifeline to the oil sands, it's a planned phase-out to help their workers. So the first place we cut oil is imported oil from Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, just cut off, and the United States cut off imports. And then the Canadian oil will come from Hibernia off Newfoundland, will reduce a lot of the oil tankers that currently go into the Port of St. John that come from all those countries I just mentioned, will just be using Hibernia oil, which we currently export about over 80% of it to the United States. So we've figured all these little elements out. Where does it go? Where does it come? We don't need a single pipeline. My goodness, there's been people who've been saying stuff on Twitter that's nonsense. I did get arrested to stop pipelines. I'm not suddenly for them. We don't need any new fossil fuel infrastructure. But in phasing it out, we're also going to need some of those workers to fix the damage that was done, because we have to fix the mess of the tailings ponds and the open pits. We have to restore the environment where the oil sands were. And one of the niftiest examples, because there's many nifty examples of transferable skills from oil sands workers to clean energy workers, but one of the nifty ones is the problem of abandoned deep oil wells. I don't know how many of you have heard the stats, but those of us in Western Canada, we have 10,000 abandoned wells in British Columbia. In Alberta, we have 100,000. And a similar number in Saskatchewan. They represent a liability in the billions and billions of dollars. But it turns out that at least 10% of them, and we can assess what the capacity is. Have you heard of geothermal, Owen?
Yes.
Okay, so you can figure out what the biggest cost of getting down to depth to do geothermal would be.
It's pretty deep.
It's the drilling. Yeah. So these abandoned wells, guess what? They're already drilled. So he doesn't have to get the water down there heated up to come up to our turbines. So we can use the oil workers who drilled the wells that are abandoned to come back and convert them to geothermal green electricity, because one of the central things for our plan is to get 100% of our electricity from renewable energy sources, ramp up our Canadian grid for electricity, then we can get rid of the internal combustion engine everywhere. So that's kind of the plan. That Spencer could be a full-fledged member of the Green Party of Canada because of all his work, even though he didn't meet our age requirements. So it's an honor to see you again. What's your question?
I know lots of people like me who have their own political opinions and stuff, so I was wondering if the Green Party had any thought about lowering the voting age so people like me could vote.
At this point, I've introduced a bill to federal parliament to lower the voting age to 16. Mike agrees with it, the leader of the Green Party in BC, Andrew Weaver, he's introduced legislation in the BC legislature to lower the voting age to 16. We think it's important, not just because there are people like you who are at a young age are very thoughtful and have figured out everything, but there are a lot of young people who need to know what it means to vote, and they miss their chance when their voting starts at 18, which is often the first year they're away from home. They don't feel as connected to the local issues. They don't have that same sense of, oh, I know so-and-so, I want to. So if we do it, and civics education in this country, which is a provincial jurisdiction, has really slipped. So if we have voting at 16, we really will be able to engage young voters, because if you vote at 16, you'll vote at 18, and you'll vote at 20, and you'll vote at 25. And by the way, if every millennial in this country votes, I'll probably be prime minister. So. Reducing emissions as quickly as possible by making the grid 100% renewable. We think we can get that done by 2030. We also can regulate. I haven't mentioned regulations yet, but if you look at the Environment Canada website and look under the term large final emitters, you actually can find out the 200 companies in Canada that are responsible for most of our emissions. And we already have, under Part 4 of the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, the ability for the Minister of Environment to regulate. So we would regulate to say that they have to reduce emissions by 30% by 2025 and 60% by 2030, just to get the ball rolling. This is how we fought acid rain in the past. We used regulations. This is how we got rid of the chemicals that were destroying the ozone layer, and the ozone layer is now repairing itself. It isn't as though we've never solved a problem before, but for some reason, Canadian governments keep one hand tied behind their back while pretending that the most they can do is a carbon price and talking nice to the provinces. And it's just, so we will go as fast as we can, because there isn't any other option, to make sure. And the other thing I haven't mentioned is international work. It kind of came up. Canada is really respected in the world. We have a lot of clout. So we need to go to the next climate negotiations, which the election is October 21st. The climate negotiations are in Santiago, Chile in December. And we need to go there and say, we were dependent on fossil fuels, and we're going off fossil fuels, and we need every other country to meet the targets we've set. Now, most countries are way ahead of us. They've done way more than we have. But if we go to that meeting and say everybody has to redouble efforts, so it's not every one Canadian by themselves, or one province by itself, or one city by itself, and it's not one country by itself. We have to all do it together. So it happens fast when it starts happening, and then it will move really fast, because once we cut the legs out from under big oil and they realize they're not getting their subsidies anymore, there's no future market, their day is done, they'll pull out all the patents they've been holding to solar.
We're going to do one more question, because we are going to, otherwise we're going to go way over time. So I'm going to go to the gentleman here. Can you ask the question quickly, though, please?
This is not actually a question. This is actually my proposal.
Okay.
Quick, please.
Yes. I'm a beekeeper, and I see devastation of the environment for decades. Now, I would like to see on every town, every main square of the town, a board which actually indicates where we are close to the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Okay, I would like to see it. It's not to panic, and I understand the depression, how the people can feel, but it's necessary.
Thank you. I just want to say before we do close, and I know that I wish we had more time for questions, but Mike and I promised we'd let you out of here. It is a little sticky, but this is a societal endeavor. I've said that before, but it will lift our spirits. This isn't to make anyone scared. When Goethe says, "I want you to panic," I have. Has everybody in this room heard of Goethe Thornburg? I realize the answer when she says, "I want you to act like your house is on fire," is that those of us who understand what has to be done say, "Right, the house is on fire. Everyone leave in an orderly fashion so no one gets hurt. Grab the fire extinguishers. Call the fire department. Let's save the house." Because that's what you do when you're grown-ups. You don't say, well, the fire's in the bedroom, and honey, get me another beer, I want to watch the end of the game. You don't do that. You say, we're going to get through this together. So when I look back, and you'll see it in Mission Possible, there's some examples. I look back at the experience of May 1940, I mentioned the war experience, because all the good advice Churchill got would have scared the hell out of anyone. Right? The good advice was, find someone to go negotiate with Herr Hitler. See if we can get a good deal. Our entire army is pinned down at Dunkirk. I mean, I know the Dunkirk story since I was a kid because my dad was British and he grew up in the Blitz and his neighbors were being blown to smithereens and he got out of it okay, but I knew the story of Mrs. Miniver and the little boats and Dunkirk, but I didn't really know the story, which was that for 5 days in May 1940, the British War Cabinet met round the clock to decide whether to surrender to Hitler. And the overwhelming advice from the military advisors, the senior civil servants, and Churchill's political opponents was, we got to get a good deal while there's time. Every nation into which Hitler's army advanced surrendered, including France, where not just some men, the entire British army was pinned down at Dunkirk. 300,000 men. They had the Luftwaffe overhead. They couldn't bring the famous British Navy in to rescue them because the beaches there were too shallow. The one hope they might have had, oh, by the way, there were no defenses to defend the island of Britain. If anyone had invaded, they didn't have any coastal defenses to repel an invading army. And their army was stuck at Dunkirk, so they called the United States for help. And, you know, maybe some things never changed, but the United States was no help whatsoever at that moment. So, I don't know how Churchill got the idea, because I've been reading a lot of books on this lately, because I've gotten kind of obsessed. There is nothing I can find to indicate who it was, other than Winston Churchill, to ask the question, how many civilian boats are in Dover? And that's a crazy question. There are 300,000 men stranded on a beach, and you've got the Luftwaffe overhead, and you think that maybe you have another asset that no one's thought of yet? 861 civilian boats, sailing boats, ferries, fishing trawlers. And that's going to go up against Hitler's army and rescue 300,000 men? Well, it's obviously not doable. But the important thing to know is they did it. And when they actually confronted an enemy and spoke it out loud, whereas the British government had actually, they didn't do polling in those days, but they did a daily morale report. And the people of England and Great Britain, without knowing, they knew what was happening with Hitler. They were incredibly depressed, but no one wanted to talk about it. Because it was so scary that if their leadership wasn't talking about it, they could only conclude it must be much scarier than they thought. So when 861 civilian vessels, minus the 200 and so that were sunk by the Luftwaffe, rescued over 300,000 men actually got rescued, including a bunch of French soldiers. With those little boats, they got the benefit of cloud cover, and they rescued all those men. And then Hitler said, well, Hitler was looking at the Luftwaffe and wondering how the British army had escaped. And Churchill said, we will never surrender. And my favorite theologian and favorite author, those of you who ever read the Narnia books, wrote in his diary, C.S. Lewis wrote of this, I find it so surprising how everyone I meet is so much more encouraged now that things are so much worse. If you're facing facts, and you know you can get your way through something, and you're not living in denialism and illusion and in some bubble of consumer happiness, if you actually face facts and rally around, I think it will improve our mental health, improve our sense of meaning in our lives, and give everyone a reason to work together to be the heroes in our own story, because that's what we're writing right now. We're writing the story, we're the heroes in our own story.
And once again, that was Elizabeth Mayer, who visited Guelph on July 15th, the regular Guelph Politicast. With this week's guest, Kevin Bowman of 123 Guelph, will be available on Wednesday as usual. Open Sources Guelph will return on Thursday, August 15. And that's it for this extra edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. You can also subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel and get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays, usually, and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is, of course, the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you on Wednesday. And until then, see you next time.